When Rudolf Hess flew to Scotland, Ian Fleming, then an intelligence officer and yet to become the creator of a series of Hitlerian villains, suggested that the only man to interview Hess was Aleister Crowley, the black magician and sometime initiate of the Order of the Golden Dawn, whose salute the Nazis had borrowed. Fleming was thus among the first to acknowledge that the Nazi government was an occult organization. You have to imagine an entire nation taken over by Jim Jones or David Koresh or Luke Jouret. Imagine the United States of America, in which everyone is a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Hi, this is Tony Gosling with the Politics Show from BCFM Friday podcast. It's Good Friday, Friday the 25th of March. BCFM don't have programs this weekend, and instead I thought I'd do a quick podcast. I hope it will be quick anyway, just to brief and update listeners as to Tuesday's attacks in Brussels. Importance of Brussels should be obvious to most people. It's the heart of the United States of Europe, the EU, and also the home of NATO. I've taken a great interest over the years in NATO's pressure and lobbying to create a United States of Europe, and through the EEC and the European Union over the years, particularly through the Bilderberg Group, which the US ambassador to West Germany many years ago said was the movement behind the European Union, the main prime movers, the Bilderbergers. So anyway, Tuesday's attacks on Brussels are pretty horrific, but in the big scheme of things, if you compare it, for example, to Yemen just last week, 80 people were killed, civilians, in a marketplace, and less than half of that number were killed in Brussels. We didn't even get any reporting in the West, pretty much, as far as I can see, of the attack on the marketplace in Yemen. British profits being made over there, £3 billion in 2015, selling arms to the Saudi Arabians. And so the comparison is enormous with the wall-to-wall coverage that the Brussels attacks are getting in the West. The effect of the Brussels attacks, well, we're already seeing pressure to relinquish sovereignty, particularly when it comes to intelligence sharing, intelligence gathering. So that is to say, you know, the most secret things that the states know around Europe, there's a lot of pressure immediately on to give those up to other European countries. And of course, I mean, there are dangers as well as positive things that could come with that. I suppose, to do with financial migrants as well. If you're looking at the whole situation with the EU, actually the EU seems to be falling apart, looking particularly at the migrant crisis and the economic crisis with the euro. So the context being the Brexit vote in June in Britain, a lot of pressure on that, obviously, as to whether Britain is going to start to lead people out of the European Union. Many countries like Switzerland and Norway have stayed out and have just seen it as a trade bloc, completely staying away from the political side of things. And the effect of the attacks on Brussels is probably going to be more towards the pressure to stay in the EU, saying, well, look, you know, we're all in this together. We need to join together to defeat ISIS. That seems to be the agenda there anyway. At least that's going to be the effect. Probably worth mentioning the appalling reporting that's been coming from Alex Jones, Paul Joseph Watson and InfoWars, which is just, I mean, is actually like Fox News with squared, you know, actually more rabid than them. And so that's interesting to see the way that this Islamic phobic agenda, all the things learnt from 9/11/77 and the other attacks, completely forgotten at InfoWars. Anyway, let's get on to actually breaking down what happened on Tuesday. First of all, we've got a new kind of suicide bomber, haven't we? The kind of suicide bomber that pushes around trolleys with their suicide bomb in or on the trolley in a bag, and then they apparently deliberately stand next to the trolley as the bomb is blown up. Now, to me, this is just farcical. Why would you do that? I mean, first of all, I've got all sorts of questions about the lack of interrogation from the mainstream press as to suicide bombings. I mean, you know, there has been very little, certainly in Brussels, saying, well, have you got any evidence of a suicide bomber? Nobody seems to want to ask the police that question. But then what about a new suicide type of suicide bomber that has no need to die? In other words, they could just leave their bomb on the trolley and walk off and survive, but yet they die anyway. So that's I found particularly peculiar about this attack. I did write a piece back in January, February 2007 for the National Union of Journalists magazine called Bombers Away! Which was really all about the whole narrative of the suicide bombing. The main premise of that piece was saying, hey, if you're going to report something as a suicide bombing, you've got to have real evidence. And I cited the apparent suicide bombing, which was reported by the Al-Sadr newspaper back in 2004, I think it was, or maybe 2005, after the British and American invasion of Iraq. The Al-Sadr newspaper was closed down by Paul Bremer and the American occupying forces because they had a front page headline which said the suicide bomber last week wasn't a suicide bomber at all, it was just a missile fired from a helicopter. Now, the whole world had been told that story about a suicide bomber, but actually eyewitnesses that the paper had got together and interviewed said no, it was a helicopter fired a missile. So this is the reason why we mustn't just instantly call suicide bombers just because the police and the other authorities tell us that that's what's happened. Always interrogate it. And in fact, we went on at the National Union of Journalists to put together a guide to reporting terrorism that looks at, you know, really chivying up particularly young journalists, and there's been lots of very young reporters over in Brussels to ask some of these questions and to report speculation as speculation. Say, for example, to say things like the Belgian police or Brussels police reports this, rather than just reporting it as fact, because they don't do that. All they're doing is they're mixing fact and speculation, which is the basic fault of journalism. You know, you can't do that. You really got to try and separate the two as much as possible. Then also there's the presence of the Belgian army at the scene of the airport attacks on Tuesday, as reported by an airport worker, Tom Donker.
Tom Donker's an airport worker. He told the BBC he'd actually just started his shift when the first explosion came.
We were going to our desks to the gate, and we looked to our left side, and it looked like 50 meters of us was a big explosion. First we thought it was a billboard falling down or something. My colleague was looking and was wondering what is it. And I said, run. We ran away. We were running very quickly. My colleague jumped into the carousel behind the check-in desk. I lost him because I didn't know where he was. I ran straight on, and it was like 20 centimeters of me. It was a big explosion, a second one, big explosion. I thought I was hurt, I was hit. And then there were two people who were working at on the airport. They told me to come inside. They locked the door. And behind a little gap, I saw a soldier putting away a body. I hope he was not dead, and he was just hit.
Tom Donker, an airport worker. The travel editor of The Independent, Simon Calder, says there is...
Tom Donker, D-O-N-K-E-R, apparently, he was talking about literally just after the exploding of the second bomb, he was ushered into a room which was kind of away from the public area. Imagine that probably wasn't sort of full of dust or whatever. The bomb had just gone off, only to find a soldier on hand dealing with a dead or injured body. Now, that to me is not normal for soldiers to be waiting for a bomb to go off like that. I mean, it may be there is a perfectly good explanation for it, but certainly this should have been reported and questions should be asked about what soldiers were doing there. I mean, did they get a warning? Maybe they did. Did they plant the bomb? possibly they did. I mean, we've certainly seen in the past that the last attacks in Belgium, which were back in the early 1980s, 1983 to 1985, with the Brabant massacres in supermarkets, where about 50 people were murdered in supermarkets, shot most of them, with these terrorists, in inverted commas, wearing carnival masks. Now, Hugh O'Shaughnessy and others have reported, I think it was in The Observer, Hugh wrote, that he'd spoken to people who put the terrorists as actually special forces, British SAS, who'd been over there to do these attacks, false flag attacks, as part of Operation Gladio, which was NATO's campaign right across Europe for several decades. Vincenzo Vinciguerra, who was one of the fascists who was arrested because he'd actually planted a terrorist bomb, and he was a fascist, but it had been blamed on the Red Brigades in Italy. He actually says in the interview on the BBC Time Watch, three-part Time Watch series from 1992, he says, in 1945, World War II ended and World War III began. Really talking about the recruitment particularly by the US, OSS, later to become CIA, of Nazi soldiers, fascist soldiers in Italy too, in order to fight communism and fight the Russians. And you know, a lot of money was spent in trying to make sure that Europe, individual European countries, did not turn to the left, and certainly didn't swung away from becoming friendly with the Soviet Union. A lot of money was spent on that. And that's essentially what Gladio is about. And in Belgium too, at the time of these Brabant supermarket massacres in Belgium in the 1980s, the Belgian government was starting to drift away from its alliance with the United States, from NATO, and start to question the need to have American weapon systems, missiles. Interesting, though, of course, it's the headquarters of NATO, Belgium, in Brussels. So this was causing quite a lot of tension, and the supermarket massacres, which were orchestrated by NATO, then swung the political leadership, the opinion formers and the public in Belgium away from the idea, because these attacks were blamed on the far left, who were supposedly being supported by the Soviet Union. So this was what Vincenzo Vinciguerra and the Italians called the strategy of tension. In other words, get the politicians afraid, and drive the politicians and the people to the secret state and the state generally for security and safety. So also it's Friday today. We've only just had the announcements of the names of the people who died in Brussels. The bodies are probably disfigured, etc. But this relatives should be told as soon as bodies are identified, straight away, really. And it does rather indicate that the authorities are concerned more with getting all the facts straight rather than for the needs of the families. Let's also look at the security. Obviously, this particular attack was outside the airport security cordon, or the main security cordon, although, yes, Brussels Airport is under the security control of ICTS. ICTS is an Israeli-owned firm, even though it appears to be a sort of multinational company, it's actually Israeli-controlled, Israeli-owned. And this is the same firm which was involved in the underpants bomber, the shoe bomber, the underpants bomber in 2009. The shoe bomber was that Richard Reid was allowed onto the plane by ICTS security without a passport. And also at Boston Logan Airport, that was also run on 9/11 by ICTS, Israeli security firm. So big questions about who was running the security for the Brussels Airport, the main Brussels Airport. G4S run the security at the southern Brussels Airport, which is way out of Brussels, actually. But again, big questions about this firm. I mean, certainly I can see no reason why anybody would want to employ ICTS, given their record, doing airport security ever again. I mean, it just seems that they must have ways and means of handshakes of getting these airport security contracts, despite their appalling record. Also, this attack indiscriminate, like the Brabant supermarket massacres. And this was, again, was part of Operation Gladio back in the 1970s, 1980s and early 90s, was self-defeating, isn't it? It's totally indiscriminate, means it's self-defeating. Therefore, it is suspicious. If the targets, nobody's been specifically targeted, then it should raise questions. Questions should be asked. Surely this does not do anything for the cause of ISIS, if indeed it is ISIS that's carried it out from some kind of command centre in Iraq or Syria. You know, maybe they're just completely autonomous little units going around. We don't know. But that is suspicious, isn't it? Where you get a self-defeating attack. So it's just, all it does is it reduces any kind of sympathy people may have for you. Of course, it's quite feasible, possible, even easy for other targets to be taken, like NATO headquarters or other sorts of targets, but not that didn't happen in this case. It's also, looking back, I mean, I mentioned the Brabant supermarket massacres. There was also, in October 2014, a couple of years ago, a jihad training camp discovered in the Ardennes, quite close to NATO headquarters. So this is very, you know, interesting, isn't it, that you've got jihadis training under the nose of NATO. Anyone would think that they had some kind of hand in this. And of course, the former DIA chief Michael Flynn, November last year, 2015, said it was a willful decision, the creation of ISIS, but to support the Syrian rebels, which are now become ISIS. And the Defense Intelligence Agency in the US, they were all saying, well, you know, if we support these rebels, we're going to have they didn't have the word ISIS at that point, but we're going to have this force on our hands. Well, how will we deal with it? Very good question. Of course, wouldn't be at all easy to deal with it. So again, just stressing, well, young reporters mixing fact with speculation. And one of the things I've heard time and time again is these young reporters saying, we know for certain. In fact, even Channel 4 News people saying, we know for certain this, we know for certain that. Well, basically, he is just a mouthpiece for the state, and he's not using interrogative journalism. I mean, I noticed, for example, I think it was last night with Channel 4 News, the announcement of the imprisonment and the sentencing of Radovan Karadzic from Bosnian Serb leader. There was not even a mention of the impunity of Tony Blair and George Bush, which is incredible, isn't it, when you think that the amount of carnage, and in fact we're living with it today, aren't we, with ISIS attack in Brussels, supposedly, done by ISIS, caused by the appalling illegal intervention in Iraq back in 2003 was the seed sowed for that. And then, you know, there's just so much going on at the moment, including the migrant crisis, which you can pin on Blair and Bush. And so, but not even a mention of the fact that these two guys have total impunity above the law. Almost like they seem to think they're gods, you know, walking around doing whatever they want. Another thing worth commenting, I think, is that the Belgian anti-terror police look like terrorists with their balaclavas on. I would like to think that our police don't have to disguise their identities, that to me is one of the differences between people who are outside the law and people who are inside the law. By wearing these balaclavas, I'm afraid these police put themselves outside the law. If they shoot somebody, I mean, who do we know? How do we know who they are? We don't know what's going on, really. I mean, today we've just had this guy shot in the legs in Belgium. Who knows whether he deserved that or not? Really, there's no questioning, no interrogation by the media about that at all. Also, social media has been spreading disinformation. This is an indication that there's an orchestrated psychological warfare campaign going on over the Brussels attacks. I've seen a couple of videos, one particularly, which is very obviously edited to make it look like somebody in the supposedly anyway in the Brussels Airport has got a plastic baby that they're carrying around, and that they're just an actor. But this is quite clearly, if you have a look at it, a fabrication, and yet it's been pushed massively on social media. Lots of anonymous, usually anonymous or fake accounts, I would imagine, pushing that. Democracy only works when you vote. It's election time again, and the supplementary voting system for Bristol's mayor and police commissioner is about as fair as it gets. Register to vote by the 18th of April and make your vote count. BCFM Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling, 5 till 7, every Friday. Our hustings for mayor are on the 8th and police commissioner on the 22nd of April, 5 till 7 on the Friday. And don't let the banksters get you down. The context of all of this going on in Brussels, though, is, I think anyway, we're in a propaganda state at the moment, which is really at World War II levels again, a kind of Goebbels-style propaganda, where questioning voices questioning security services, questioning intelligence services, questioning police, just simply are not there. And that's what I'd like to, this is one of the indications for me as to whether something's wrong or not, is when you see the police being questioned, when you see the sorts of questions that are being asked down the pub in Brussels, like, oh, this may be like those attacks we had, the last terrorist attacks we had here in Brussels, which were carried out by NATO. You're seeing absolutely none of that being indicated by the press at all. And this is all part of the rollback of the state and the rollback of accountability, which has been going on all over the Western world, particularly. What does that mean? Well, it means secrecy becomes the norm. And big corporations start to become far more powerful than the government. And, of course, the media are those big corporations. Our taxes we pay generally are not spent on us so much anymore. And the Europe that through the EU and the United States are becoming more like a factory, you know, sort of run for profit by business people. Business people coming into government, there's revolving doors, and then they just look at government as a kind of profit centre and people as a profit centre. And the media is part of that big corporate, the change that's been going on in the corporate world. We had Roberto Saviano, author of the excellent book 000, recently saying in The Guardian, I can't remember the author, maybe I will in a minute, but The Guardian writer, that Ed Vulliamy, that's right, explaining that the big corporations now, including financial services companies and media, are starting to model themselves on the narco-trafficking cartels, because they've realised that there's a very much a light touch touch regulation, obviously very light touch in financial services world. It's 2008, there's loads of financial crooks, none of whom have gone to jail. Instead, what they've done is they've set up people like Tom Hayes, the trader whose son of a World in Action journalist, in fact, just this week we've heard about the German Bourse merging with the London Stock Exchange. Actually, it's a takeover, it's not a merger. And the guy that's going to be in charge of the two bourses together is the guy who was the mastermind of the LIBOR fraud scandal, and that's who Tom Hayes fingered for being responsible for telling him, showing him how he must fix the LIBOR rates at UBS in Switzerland. So, you know, this is a criminal elite. It's simply a criminal elite. The banksters, and also, of course, we've got in the background the VIP paedophiles essentially running things, and the media being swept up in this complete change and lack of regulation, lack of legality, impunity for the richest and most powerful. The targets for the propaganda are the MPs. The MPs and other decision makers. And I also think it's worth looking at the EU as regards this Brexit vote and the way that the EU has really been pushing all the time, pushing this whole corporate agenda on us. So rollback of government and I mean, you could even call it a Nazi occupation. Some do. If you go back to 1942 in Berlin, there was the Hitler's idea for Germania, which was a kind of German capital for the European Economic Community in 1942. And I'll pop some of the links up, not on our show page, probably on the 911forum.org.uk to some of these things. And then in June 1944, you had a meeting between Hermann Schmitz from IG Farben and Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's treasurer, in June 1944. And that was a meeting to design a whole program for financial camouflage of the Nazi wealth that they'd got from looting the whole of Europe, basically. And then we had on the 10th of August 1944, the Red House meeting in Strasbourg, that was organized by Bormann, although he wasn't there. And there was a morning meeting for all of the German industrialists. And what they would do effectively was, and the Germans perfected this method, a kind of cartel method, really, of buying up shares in banks generally. Those were the banks, because, you know, these are private banks, not national banks. And those, by buying up shares in those national banks, like the banks in France and Paris, etc., they also bought ownership of the big French industries. So by the time the Germans invaded France in the Second World War, they owned many of the big industrial plants, the heavy industry, you know, things like the steelworks and manufacturing plants. And so the Wehrmacht and the SS were told, oh, well, don't destroy that plant because we own it anyway. And then, of course, once they'd taken over, they'd overrun France, these Germans would come into the plants, the Nazis would arrive and explain, oh, well, already we've got two or three people on the board of your organisation, so it's not going to be all that much of a change. It's just a kind of change of emphasis. And so that was in the morning. This was the methods which were being promulgated at the Red House meeting in Strasbourg on the 10th of August 1944. So in the morning it was the industrialists' turn. At lunchtime, most of the non-military industrialists, all of them, were asked to leave, and the afternoon was just for the German military, and which that was the formal beginning of the Nazi flight capital program, where all of the bearer bonds, which are like basically like cash but they're shares in companies, were secreted abroad over many months, actually till the end of the war, really. There was another, what is it, about 6-8 months to go of World War II in August 1944. Many to Argentina, many through Spain, many in Switzerland, some to Japan, but not so many. Mostly, I think it's probably fair to say, South America, Argentina being the real focus, and Buenos Aires. And then on the 29th of May 1954, we had the first Bilderberg Conference took place, and that was chaired by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, a former SS officer who'd been involved, it looks pretty certain now, in betraying the British plans to liberate Holland, Operation Market Garden in September 1944. He was the Dutch liaison officer, even though he didn't really know Holland, he was German. Bernhard was trusted on that operation with all the intelligence beforehand, and his trusted, so-called trusted spy, Christian Lindemans, otherwise known as King Kong, was parachuted into a few days before the operation, supposedly to liaise with the Dutch resistance, just before Operation Market Garden, the film A Bridge Too Far, is all about that, just before it started. And he went straight to the Wehrmacht, betrayed all of everything. So certainly the chair the chair of Bilderberg for the first 20 years is an extremely iffy character, this former SS officer Bernhard of the Netherlands. And along with him afterwards as chairman was Lord Carrington, who again was involved in that Operation Market Garden. He was captain in the tank of the Grenadier Guards, who'd crossed the Nijmegen Bridge, which had just been won by the Americans on in 90, I think it was the Wednesday evening of that operation, And yet he sat there. In fact, it's in the, Robert Redford, you can see a little scene in the film about this where the Americans say, well, look, we've just taken this bridge. Why don't you just roll down the road just a few miles to Arnhem and save the day, when they just sat around and twiddled their thumbs for 17 hours until the battle was lost. So I think, in a way, the whole Bilderberg thing is a bit of a an in-joke, you know, that this was the place where British basically betrayed their own side in order to extend the war, so the Nazis had time to for their flight capital program. And the thing that really made me think that was when you look at the actual spot where the first Bilderberg meeting took place, which is the Bilderberg Hotel in Oosterbeek. Well, it's exactly the same, in the same spot where the British 1st Airborne Division in Oosterbeek was surrounded 10 years before in the Battle of Operation Market Garden. And they called it the Witch's Cauldron because the British were absolutely hammered by the Nazi forces, including these two recuperating SS Panzer divisions. I mean, with things like rocket launchers, they were absolutely hammered. And it was a kind of a bit of an in-joke, but not very funny. I mean, it's just the sort of thing, I suppose, that you'd you wouldn't want to talk about because it was so grim if you were in the British Army. Anyway, that, I think, is a sort of basic summary of where we're at with corporate power and also with the attempt to bounce all the European leaders through this attack in Brussels. Whoever's been behind it, I mean, we really don't know yet. And this is one of the other things, isn't it, that always should raise questions, is if you know exactly who's done it within just a few days, then you know, very, very difficult to believe that, you know. So maybe some trials, that kind of thing, before you're actually saying this person did this and this person did that. The other convenience, of course, with the suicide bomber motif is, number one, is it just demonizes the so-called enemy as someone who's completely crazy. It's a very good way of just making out that someone is, you can't even reason with them. If it's, you know, if it's true, this is why you shouldn't label someone as a suicide bomber if you don't have any real evidence. And, you know, that's, I suppose, one of the main reasons I like to look deeper into this, is because there's a kind of repulsion to looking at these sorts of things properly. Anyway, so I think I've run through pretty much what most of my thoughts to do with the attack on Brussels. 33, I think, people so far killed. But let's not forget the 15,000 children killed and injured in Yemen, the 15,000 civilians disabled for life in Yemen, 80 people killed in the marketplace last week in Yemen, you know, no electricity for hospitals and schools in Yemen at all, 510 hospitals destroyed and closed, the Saudi Arabians destroying food storage warehouses day after day, week after week, attempting to starve the people, population. I mean, these are all quite obviously serious war crimes, very little, if anything, being done about it, and certainly very little media coverage of it, and a lack of awareness. There's hundreds of thousands of people turning up on the streets in Yemen for protests. They're going unreported. A total of 8,500 civilians killed over there. So let's look at the, you know, the sort of balance between the way that the 34 or so people killed in Brussels on Thursday is compared to the 8,500 civilians over the last year or so in Yemen, because money's being made out of the Yemen crisis. And I guess that's where I'm going to end it. And hopefully we'll give you a decent report, a bit of a better report, with some other voices, not just me, next Friday on BCFM 93.2. And you can follow the programme and get the link to the live listen at www.thisweek.org.uk. And don't let the banksters get you down. Signal from you, bring me
signal.